Patrick McGarren Books has been in business since 1969.
Yeah.
And they've been selling rare books. They've published 292 catalogs of rare, scarce, and interesting books in a wide variety of subjects. Their specialties include the Arctic, Canadian history and travel, the Americas, fishing and angling, Ireland, general antiquarian and military history. They issue 7 to 10 catalogs a year. And I am here with Patrick McGarren, who is celebrating 50 or 51 years in business.
I'll be 51 in December the 12th.
Welcome to the Bibliophile.
Thank you.
For the second time.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I remember doing this in the basement of the store on Bank Street. That's 783 Bank Street.
That's right. And in fact, I was just listening to that. It's about 10 or 12 years old, that interview. At the end of it, I said, well, we're going to have to do this in another 10 years.
Here we are. Yeah, consistency, eh?
Yeah, keeping our word.
Yeah, keeping on.
Yeah. Okay, so I recently read through the Oxford Companion to Canadian Literature, and I identified a bunch of books that were interesting for one reason or another. And I looked some of them up, and in almost every case, you had a copy.
Really? Yeah.
So my admiration for you has only grown since we last met.
Yeah, thanks.
How do you go about, first of all, deciding what books to carry? Do you go through these reference guides?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I use those books all the time. In fact, if you can see behind me here, this room is all bibliography, books on books. And this is the catalog. I have another room with at least most booksellers do, but I use this stuff all the time. Some of it has shifted now to the internet. Of course, there are a lot of bibliographies and online. So WorldCat and Hub. I used to have like a whole bay of just auction records, you know, and it would take you anywhere from 5-10 minutes to half a day to track down a book in there. There's two responses to doing that. One is that you find the book. It is kind of rare. You don't find many listings, and that tells you that, you know, a bit about the book. There's another reaction is you go through all of them and you don't find any auction records. And that means one of two things. Either the book is so rare it never comes to auction, or it's so common nobody bothered putting it at auctions. So there's your new dilemma. So it's funny because sometimes you're, you know, as the chase goes on, you begin to hope that you don't find it, right? Because not finding it means that it's really rare, especially if you know that it is intrinsically going to be a good book. Nowadays, of course, with Hub and some of those things, it takes maybe 10 seconds from start to finish to look up every auction record back to 1900. So the other thing about all that stuff too is that having done it for many years, you become very sensitive to where it was auctioned, who the auctioneer was, who the buyer was. The same with when you go on ABE, it's not even the prices so much, because most of those are stolen prices, you know. It's like Yeats's Lost Child. It's not that bookseller's price. 98% of those guys are looking at what everybody else is doing and they do it, right? So you're not really learning. You know, a book is worth what you can sell it for, not what you can put on it. You can put anything you want on it. And lots of people do, right? It's like a flight into fantasy. So what's important is, what can you sell it for? So when I'm looking at those records, I'm seeing, you know, is that David Mason? Is that Lake? Is that Naughton's in Scotland? Is that Meigs? Who is this? That tells me more about the book. And, you know, and you're basically just filling in many cases, what your instinct tells you in the first place, kind of thing.
Yeah, one of the things that's annoying is that, well, as you say, it's supply and demand, but you look through a reference guide like the Oxford Companion to Canadian Literature, you find that there's a book in there that's really important for a variety of different reasons. You look it up on the internet and you find a variety of different prices that are maybe not that, and yet it's a really important book. So how does that work?
Yeah. You know, in the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, there was I think one in five or six catalogs was Canadian Literature. But that whole market was pretty much driven by institutional buying. Places like Ottawa U, where the librarian said to me, you know, we're teaching courses on Canadian Literature. We don't have any. You know, they were very thin. So I remember once that I think they bought about a third of a whole catalog one time on that basis. Also, in those days, Canadian Literature was being taught in universities across the country. Mm-hmm. And that made for the interest that you're just suggesting there. Like when people got to know it, they, you know, some of those kids would turn up in the store and they'd be looking for things. And well, that's all changed. I don't know anybody that's teaching. I know my daughter went to Sackville.
So did mine.
Yeah. There was a guy who was an Ottawa man, actually. He set up a whole collection of Canadiana there. Well, when Deirdre was going there, the place was closed. There were no Canadian history or literature courses being taught. Carleton had, you know, an army of people, Sandra Campbell and on. And that's not being taught anymore. And actually, the other hack and you and cry would be very little is taught in high school as well. I mean, what's taught is more social history than, you know, how they dressed in 1920. And so those things do have an effect for sure.
They drive the prices. If they're being taught, there are more people that are interested in the books.
Absolutely. And it's not a case of is there a market or isn't there? Well, of course, this is true of a lot of subjects, not just Canadian literature. I mean, there's a lot of subjects that at one time were as good as gold. I was recently looking at, I think it was catalog number 8. I pulled out of my archives here. And the books, there was even $3, $5, $7.50, $12.50, $25, and the odd book at $50. But the interesting thing is, there must have been 40 orders there. The folder with the order, filled orders in it, I think there was 40 or 45 orders in there. I couldn't get over that. I mean, now, you know, on a catalog, you get like 10, 12, maybe 20 would be the max. Also in those days, a lot of institutions bought books. Now that you can count them on one hand, you know. So that those are kind of sea changes, really.
So 40 orders out of how many books that were posted in the catalog or mailed out?
Well, the books were of lower retail value. And, you know, that's also a reflection of the cost of living and those sorts of things. I can tell you a story about that in a minute. Nowadays, you're trying always to catalog rare books. In those days, you just catalog books, period, that you thought would be interesting or there would be some demand for. And most of the catalogs would be 150, 200 books. In fact, we do now, you know, anywhere from 60 to 80 books. Well, in the old days, some of the old guys would get upset if you call that a catalog. That was a misnomer. That was a list. And then you see, you know, like Quaritch and Meigs with no computers, they did catalogs with 800 or 1500 books in them. I once did a three-part catalog on the Arctic. It was one of the first catalogs that were solely on the Arctic. There were a couple of British dealers that had done catalogs prior, where all the books were about the Arctic. And that was in three parts, and it was 1,200 books. Man, that had real impact in its day. Like, there were people in Norway, there were people in New York. I mean, everybody was talking about this kid in Ottawa. In fact, one guy from Denmark, a dealer, Vinderskov, he saw the catalog on somebody's desk in New York in another bookstore. And he went and got on a plane and flew to Ottawa because he figured that if one guy had that many books, then the mother load was behind there. He was wrong about that, but it certainly had an impact in its day. So,
how did you get those books on the Arctic? Was it just that you lucked into someone who had a library in the region and you bought it?
No, there was a guy in Vancouver, Ned Bose was his name. He was a bookseller. He decided he was getting out of the thing, and he offered it to me as a collection. My colleagues were advising me not to do it, but I did it anyway. The good thing about advice is that you should always listen to it, but don't necessarily take it, you know. I just figured 1,300 books on one subject has got to be good. It just has to have an impact. Indeed, there were some problematic books in there, but now that reminds me of another story. No, that book about the relative things, I always remember a guy, he was an admiral. He was in my store on Bank Street about 1995. He was looking at Canadian scenery, and he asked me, why was it so much? It was $1,200 at the time. So I explained to him that it was an extraordinarily clean, fine copy. You know, normally you could get an average copy for $800-$900, but this warranted the extra. So he looked at the books and he looked at me and he said, you know, when I was a captain stationed in London, England, I saw one of these just like this for the equivalent of $200. And he said, as a captain, on my salary, I couldn't afford it.
Damn.
It bugged me. And he said, he kind of laughed, chuckled, and he says, you know what? Now I can. And he bought it. So it's all right. You know, it's all, he's right. I mean, you know, 1960.
So obviously condition was the key to the pricing there.
Yeah. Well, actually you can still get a set of that, like a really, really top-notch one. Of course, they're hard to get. I would say, you know, 1,200 to 1,500 these days. In the original cloth, it's usually red, and it's lavishly gilt-decorated with, you know, natives and costume and beautifully decorated binding. You know, it was an immensely successful book in its day, really.
What was it called? Canadian Scenery?
That's it. Yeah.
Published by who?
Virtue. Joyce Banks, who was the rare book librarian, spent a lot of time on the bibliography on that book. The steel engravings were, you know, they're very durable, and they had a high contrast. So they're very sharp, and they were continuing to use those plates up until 1882. They were still printing from those plates and illustrating books for them.
When was it first published?
1842. And the whole trick to identify the first, Virtue was the publisher, and they were opening in New York about the same time. So there's a little trick there, the way I think it's Virtue and Company, London, and then just Virtue and Company without London on it indicates New York. It's something like that. That's not exact, but it's one of those deals. But they just kept issuing it with the same date engraved on the plates, you know.
Okay. So you would go through, for example, the Oxford Companion to Canadian Literature. You'd also go through Waters, right? The great bibliography.
Yeah, I've worn out a copy of that book already.
So how would it work? You would go through that and then you would identify books that are important. And then what would you do? How would you get them?
I wouldn't be going through those to identify whether they're important or not. I think I would feel that I knew that in the first place. Like something, I would get the books. You know, Bernard Atman said to me when I was starting, and one of the great lessons, he asked me if I had a set of Hunter's Ottawa Scenery. And I said to him, well, no, that book is not very saleable in Ottawa. And he said, well, do you have one? And I said, no. And he said, no. First you get it, then you sell it. Well, like I have a Canadian literature here section, like you're talking about, but I haven't produced a catalog because I don't have the feeling that there's an audience out there beyond myself.
I'm interested, Patrick.
Yeah. You know, that's another thing I've often said to new booksellers is, or even sometimes when I'm buying, one or two good books are almost hopeless. What you need is 200 good books on the same subject.
So what, then you can put together a catalog?
Then you can do a catalog. And catalogs have impact. You're delivering, you know, the whole vehicle in a sense. You're providing choice, comparison points. People think, oh, that's too expensive. Gee, I like that book, but I'll think about it. You know, that's the kind of process that people go through. I assume they do. I know that's what I do when I'm reading somebody else's catalog. And then you get down to that says, well, I think that I'm probably paying too much here, but I think I'm going to buy that anyway. Kind of how it works. But.
So back in the day, you say institutions bought from you and bona fide collectors bought from you and people coming in off the street bought from you. What was the breakdown back when you started and what's it like now?
Well, then there was a secondhand trade because, for instance, if you went to Prospero Books at Billings Bridge in 1975 looking for A.C. Benson or somebody obscure like that.
Very funny.
Yeah. They would say, no, try the secondhand bookstores. Go down Bank Street. So I had, up the stairs and along the balcony, that was all literature there, almost to the back, alphabetic. And like every day people would, because you couldn't get those. Well, now that's all massively reprinted. I mean, you know, you can, and not only that, you couldn't make a living at it because I bought books at Billings Bridge, new books, you know, Josephine Tay and a few things like that, $6, you know, like, and not bad. I mean, nice enough covers, paper's a bit pulpy, but quite readable, you know, like who could make a living selling that? I mean, that wouldn't, you'd have to sell huge volumes. Of course, you know, Amazon and those people do sell huge volumes. So that's how they get by. But, you know, a guy on Bank Street is, so essentially, really, there's hardly any secondhand market anymore. It's more specialty books, more rare books. So,
right. So you're saying for bricks and mortar stores, the secondhand market's pretty well shriveled up because you can get so much cheap stuff online. Is that what you're saying?
I'd say so, yeah. Like you've been in our store on Dalhousie. We haven't been open since the start of COVID, but I have to tell you, we really haven't noticed much of a difference. I mean, lots of people come in there. On Murray, yeah. And you know, they all have positive things to say about how much but they don't buy anything. So, I mean, it stops being flattering after one or two visits.
You're not a public gallery.
Well, so anyway, the point is our business really is the catalogs. It's the rare book business. It's quoting. It's, book fairs would be a part of it, and not somebody casually walking in and just buying a book. Usually when that happens, it's somebody we know, or it's somebody, one day I was in there, and a fellow from North Bay came in. He said he was interested in Canadian military history. And I could tell just the way he said that, that he already had a good collection of books. You know, I've heard these questions all my life. So sometimes I answer before the guy gets the question out, if you know what I mean. You kind of, not good. Anyway, and he did, I didn't, you know, I said, it's right there. And he did what bibliophiles do. He's not interested in me or where the bathroom is or where to get a coffee or how nice everything is. He went right to the books and he went to work. And about 20 minutes later, he said to his wife who came to the door, I'll just be another few minutes, which took 15. And he came up with four books, bought them, you know, off he went. I've often noticed that those people that come in and go, like some of the, I used to have a lady from Hudson, Quebec, and she came three times a year, and she could do the whole store upstairs, downstairs in 30 minutes. And she would buy anywhere, never more than $25 on a book. And she would buy 8 to 10 books. And when you were piling them up, you'd say, geez, that's a good book, you know, like every book was well chosen. And she probably read that. I mean, there are lots of people like that. You know, that lady had to read a book a day or every 2 days kind of thing.
When you said that's a good book, what did you mean?
Well, just, you know, it's like it's a good book on the subject. So she had subject interests, literature, read a lot of literature. She had a collection of books on Spain. She had, you know, several interests that she was pursuing, but then she would also buy books outside of that.
What else then has changed? You're saying that the footfall traffic is way down now. What else has changed?
Well, the whole internet, ABE books, Amazon, that whole marketing thing has changed a lot. I didn't mention the internet business. We do. Actually, it's gone up during COVID. More people buying orders from all corners of the globe. So pretty much that's the big change, I would say. Not much bricks and mortar and much more internet shipping. We do a lot of shipping. Do you know that the book by Biffle? I think it's The Diary of a Bookseller. He's in on the border of England and Scotland. You know that book?
Yeah.
That's a great book in that, like the day-to-day workings of a big general. I'd love to go there and have a look at his book, but books. But I know, I have a sense of what that store would be like. But that to me is a good modern book on, you know, how the book trade works now, as opposed to 50 years ago. You know, when we were talking about people who come into the store and don't buy. You know, Marius, he worked for Peter Ellis recently, and he worked for Rota before. Isn't that awful? Anyway, he's been in the book trade for as long as I have. He's a poet. And anyway, we were talking recently, and he said that subject came up. And he said, you know, about 20 years ago, when somebody said to me as they went to the door, how much they loved books. He said, I really regret doing this, but I began keeping track of how many of them ever bought a book.
Yeah.
Zero. It's a polite excuse to get out of there without, that's what it is really, you know, but it's said sincerely.
They love them, but they don't want to own them.
Yeah. Yep. Unlike us, eh?
Yeah. Now, you mentioned Bernard Ampman giving you advice about I think it was just to have the book before you tried to sell it.
Can't sell a book if you don't have it. Sometimes people will want to, over the years, they'll say, well, I have this book. Why don't you try and sell it? but they don't want to give it up. You can't sell a book you don't have. It doesn't work.
So in other words, you have to buy it outright. Is that it?
You have to have it. I have to have the book when you're looking at it, right? I can't say, oh, I'll run over to you, Nigel's place and get that and bring it. That's right away as a turnoff. Without
so in other words, they have to be able to put it in their hands. Is that what you're saying?
You have to show it. Yeah. I say I don't sell books. I make them available. You know, I present them. And then the decision to buy is yours. So I believe this, that like part of buying a book is seeing the book. You know, we're finding that pictures in the catalog and on the internet are really very important. They sometimes lie terribly, of course, but anyway.
So in 50 years in business, what's the most important thing you've learned then?
I don't know. I guess the one thing is when I'm looking at books, I always try hard to buy them. And in these years, I've ended up with a lot more books than anybody should have. You know, there's times when the volume coming in was more than you could, but I don't think I'm not sure about the answer on that. I'll think of a good one later, but.
No, that's fine. And no pressure. Although I didn't understand what you just said.
I've accumulated, when we left Bank Street, we had about 40,000 books. And the big thing is that I was always picking the books. I never bought just for the sake of quantity or I'll take all those. I've never wanted to do that. I go through and select them. So that this residue that I accrued over the years are all fairly well selected. That's the point. And now in the last 10, 15 years, as the supply of really good stuff diminishes, I suspect there's a lot of people like that where, you know, I can go to the warehouse or Liam's basement and pull out a box. Mrs. Pike, do you remember Mrs. Pike or Mel? She'd be before your time. She had Ye Olde Bookstore. She was on Bronson and she was a great character. She was an English lady. And she told me when she was buying books, if there was one box that looked good, she would put it in the back and near the back door and cover it with this cloth. On a really rainy, depressing day, she'd say to herself, I know, I'll go and get that box. Cheer herself up. So that's the essence. I suppose maybe that's where I kind of have that instinct, you know, not to worry about the fact that you weren't processing every book that you got.
Right. Well, as I say, looking through your inventory online, I really do get this sense that these books were all, you know, they kind of went through your brain. And they were selected maybe because there's an interesting story behind each one of them. And I suppose, is that what you do when you select books? You think, okay, I can sell this because of this.
Yes. Yeah. You think that. And as long as you're aware of that, about the third time you're wrong. I once had a colleague who's known for his high prices. He saw something in my catalog and he said to me, which I found really kind of hurtful a bit, gee, you got a high price on that. And I thought, boy, there's the kettle calling, you know. And I reacted defensively. And then he said, no, I don't disagree with the price. I think the price is right, but I also think there's nobody else out there that's going to agree with you. He was right about that.
Isn't that so much the case, though? It's like if you get excited about a book that, you know, may have been written by, what was his name? I think it was Godwin Smith, if I'm not mistaken.
I bought his library in Rockcliffe in 1970.
No.
Honest to God. Yeah, I did. Yeah.
He wrote a very interesting book about, I think he called it The Canada Problem or something like that. And it was basically, it was Canada will not continue to exist because there's a pull to joining the United States and we're just strung across the top. Yeah. It's controversial. And that's always been a concern to Canadians right up to modern times. Seems to me that that is a really important book. But I got it from you for maybe $20.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, What's that all about?
Well, I bought his, I shouldn't say I bought his library. I didn't get the Canadiana, but he also collected Greeks and Romans, especially the Greeks. And I got a really nice collection of, you know, the Loeb classics with the Greek and English or Latin. And so I got these books and I priced them all. And there was a whole bay of them. And they put them out and they sat. I was kind of crushed. This is the early days and nobody even looked there for about 2 months. And then one day a guy came in, a young guy came in and he bought two or three, came back the next day, he bought five or six. He came back again. He bought a few more. Turned out that he taught at Carleton. And so on the third day, he said, well, next week, I'm going to tell some of my colleagues about this, but I'm not telling them until he was sure he was done. And he did. And I had a parade of people in there. And it did sell extremely well, actually.
He put his name in them or not? Is it Godwin or Godwin?
As I remember, he did. Actually, I have a whole shelf of Goldwin Smith here, if you downstairs. But there again, you see, there was a time when I would catalog and sell those books. It was mainly institutional buying. And there was some people that were interested in him. I remember a guy who was interested from the point of view that philosophically, he was kind of outside the box thinker for his day.
He wrote about education, I think.
Yeah, and I think he probably stepped on a few toes and was not popular because of that, actually.
Yeah, well, I think was he anti-Semitic or he was, you know, at the time, it may not have been a big deal, but he was racist in some way. And of course, that undermines any kind of interest in him these days.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's true. I didn't know him or, you know, I just remember getting the call, going there. I don't know if I was referred or not. And very pleased to buy the books. And they were very pleased to help me get them out of there, you know.
Yeah, so, sure.
I remember once being in a house in New Edinburgh. And it was one of those cases of a weak house in a strong area. And the books were okay. And there was a few pretty good books and a couple of really great books, but they were in a very awkward. So I offered on the really good ones. And it was a real estate company handling the affair. And I think it was like $1,200 I suggested. And the guy said, no, we want to sell them all. And I said, I can't use them all. He said, well, how about this? Take all the books and don't pay us anything. Just get them out of here this afternoon. And I said, in other words, you're paying me to be a removal service.
Yeah.
And he said, young man, do you have any idea what this house is going to sell for? Get the books out of here. They just wanted. So it puts it all in perspective sometimes.
Yeah, in fact, that's what Marvin Post does very well down in London. He goes in and he will take the whole shooting match, and that's what most people want, as opposed to a dealer who comes in and just picks a handful and then leaves.
Yeah, I'm afraid I'm more in the second category than the first, although Liam and I always go on a house call, warning one another not to buy this and not to buy that, and why are you buying this and all that stuff. And then he's always more at me than I am at him on that thing. And then when we, it's quite funny. Then when we get there, we have all these rules on the way in, and all of them go out the window immediately. And then you start hearing conversations. Did you see this? What about that? Well, this looks good.
Yeah.
So yeah. There you are, dragging out all these. Anyway.
Do you find that there are more house calls now than in the past, or it's about the same, or what?
I'd say about the same. Right now, the books are coming over like water over Niagara Falls. And that's the generational thing. I remember, when I was on Medcalf Street, I had Barry Mather and Max Saltzman and people like that coming to me weekly looking for Hinty books. Hinty books you could sell like every day in the 70s. And that slowed a bit in the 80s. And now you can still sell Hindi books because they have those lovely pictorial bindings on them. I have a whole bunch that I wouldn't ever read one of them, but boy, I like looking at them.
You know?
Yeah. But I realize what's going on there is like Barry Mather at that time, he had the big collection. Diefenbaker supposedly had some as well. Guys who wanted to get on his good side, but buy a Henty and give it to him as a gift. And he liked getting them. He didn't like paying for them, I don't think. But anyway, that was a generational thing, you know. Those were guys who got one in with their orange at Christmas. They got one gift. How many guys told me that story? They got an orange in their stocking and one Henty book, you know, and they were delighted. And now in their 70s and their 80s, you know, that was a real kind of nostalgia thing. It passed. They passed, and yeah. The demand, you see, that's yeah. So that's what's going on with like the general household accumulation of books. It's just, I mean, even the people that take books in the charity stores are beginning to look at you like a little, don't come in here kind of, but giving away those books.
Oh, yes. Well, you know, I mean, some libraries, many libraries, you know, the big libraries in the States, special collections libraries, I've heard that if you want to donate your books to them, you have to pay them. It takes time and money to catalog books.
I had dinner with some librarians and a collector in Toronto 2 years ago at the book fair. And I was talking about somebody who gave books to an institution and the books were treated badly. And one librarian said, as an aside to the other one, yeah, another instance of a collector giving his books to an institution and not giving him the money to maintain the collection.
Yeah.
Years ago, that librarian I talked about at Ottawa U, she told me that it was their cost, I think, was something like $36 to put a book on the shelf. I don't remember the number exactly, but, you know, I was like, it's yeah. a lot. So you have to pay somebody to do it and the carting and all that kind of monkey business. So
when we met last time to talk, you mentioned three booksellers who had helped you when you were young. I wonder if you could just give me a little bit of a thumbnail on each of them. The first one is Grant Woolmer.
Yeah, Grant was a great guy. He was in the Merchant Marine during the war. And when you went into Grant Woolmer's store in Montreal, when there was nothing to do or nobody to talk to and he wasn't working, he paced up and down the store. That came from being in the Merchant Marine on night watch, walking back on, and he never got over it. The other thing, great thing about Grant Woolmer was when you went in there, if you were a bookseller especially, no matter what time of the day you went, as soon as you appeared, work was over for Grant. You went to lunch, you had a few drinks, but mostly you sat around and told stories until, and it was hard to get to look at the books because he wanted to tell stories all the time. So,
what was the name of his store?
Grant Wilmer Books. He started out on McGill College, and he had tremendous stories. He really did.
Remember any?
Well, one was, he said one day, he was usually trying to get out of there by 5 o'clock because he lived in NDG and he had to get home and stuff like that. And he said there were some kids in the shop and he had some things to wrap. And he said they were kind of going around. He got a lot of university students in. And he said they were kind of giggling and that sort of stuff. But he didn't pay too much attention. And he had about 20 minutes. He said, look, I'm sorry, I got to go now. And they said, oh, that's okay. And off they went. He said about 2 weeks later, a guy was in the store and he's looking at a book. And all of a sudden he slams the book and he said to Grant, you're friggin' crazy. And he marched out of the store. And he noticed that people were, this was like a new phenomenon, like people were getting really angry and leaving. So what's going on here? So he got off his chair and started looking through his books. They randomly went through the books. That's what they were giggling about. And they erased $12. They took out the period and moved it to the end of the zeros. Grant had a lot of stories like that. He was a really good bookseller. He told me when I was like this in 1971, he said, get a sectional bookcase and keep your best books in there. And he said, you'll find that some customers will go for that case every time and you'll be surprised at what you sell out of there. So I did that. And of course, he was right about that.
Do you have any kind of label on it or sign, or are you just kind
no,
of...
No, not a thing. No, I just remember having those sectional bookcases, and I had like any better Canadiana or books in nice bindings or, you know, that kind of thing. And then, of course, it makes you more conscious and you start looking for things. The other story I have about Grant, I can think, it's when you press the button, you see it starts to happen. Grant used to... he used to send his books that he was having restored or rebound in leather. Those days, you know, it was like 25, 50 bucks a volume. It's now 500, you know, but yeah. That amazed me. He didn't bother putting any instructions in them. He just sent them off, you know. So I was there one day and he got, and this is exciting when the books come back from, he had about 12 books in there. And, you know, 9 of them were really good. And then he came to some that were near the bottom. There was a book there that was bound in pink, another one in purple, with inappropriate bindings. I thought it was really kind of funny if they weren't your books. Like, these were good books that were made really ugly. Oh, yeah, he said, you know, that's some new guy practicing on
It's like trying to sell a car that's purple.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So, well, and it's mostly fairly conservative and people like nice bindings, but they don't like gaudy bindings.
What about next one on the list, Jerry Sherlock?
Jerry Sherlock was respected, highly respected by everybody in the trade, and I'm sure all his customers as well. He was very generous. Actually, I was in the Old Favorites in Toronto when I introduced myself.
That's the name of the store?
Yeah, it was the Old Favorites. It was on Wellington Street and then on the next one up. And his son-in-law continued up until... I think around 2000, and then he moved up north, changed the name around Aurora or somewhere. But Old Favorites was the big secondhand bookstore in downtown Toronto for years, and the original guy was Lou Morris. So I told him I was a bookseller and yada yada, and he said, well, I could tell you a lot of things, but he said, the best thing I can tell you, do you type? And I said, no, well, no. He said, no, type. take a course. And then it was practical, but man, he was right about that. Like, you know, in those days, the typewriter keys were, that was a constant in any store, you know, cataloging. But anyway, Jerry Sherlock came in to do some deal with Lou Morse. And he said to me, now here's the man you should really meet. He knows more about books. And so Jerry invited me to come out to the house. I did the next day. And he went through his cupboards and he pulled out back catalogs. And it was like a course in bookselling. And we sat around his kitchen table and he was just very, really generous that way. What was the
most important piece of advice that he gave
you? Well, he gave me a lot of information on cataloging. And like he said, the big thing about cataloging is you got to do them consistently. It takes a while to build up customers. And like most people's reaction initially, they're probably already getting catalogs like librarians, but they're not going to order from you probably the first time. Maybe when they see five or six, then they might give you a try. One of the things I remember him telling me that you're not really in business until you start buying back collections from customers. I remember thinking at the time, well, that's impossible. I mean, how do you sell books to a guy and then, you know, obviously you can't pay him what he's paid, you know, for the books. But he was right about that, actually. Like the best buys I've had over the years, almost invariably, high percentage, would have come from people I've known for many years who've been collectors. You know, like I had Dr. Hicks's collection. That was 280 cartons of books, Canadian.
Wow.
Yeah. Two Canadiana, Canadian medicine, Atlantic Canadian literature. I don't know how many catalogs we did out of that. And then a terrific kind of collection of rare books up on, you know, first editions of Beckwith and Boswell. And he was a doctor in Austria in the late 50s, and then he spent some years. He told me that, for instance, he had a collection of science and medicine portraits, steel engraved parts, all pre-1900. There was like, how many volumes? Like three folio volumes of this stuff. And he just collected that stuff in Austria out of the bins. He would go around to the stores on Saturday. And then he would have written up a little bio on each guy and put a name on them. And they're all kind of nicely presented and that sort of stuff. So that was a terrific collection.
How did you come up with a price to offer him?
Well, I guess I just did what I always did. In that case, I think I spent two or three days there. I just sort of began on the first thing and went through and just kept adding up and making notes. And I came up with a number and we came up with a deal. He was very pleased.
What would you do? Would you say, okay, I'll give him 10% of what I think I can sell it for, or 20%?
Oh, no, much more than that. Because, the heart of the collection wouldn't be much bigger than, I mean, the really rare stuff wouldn't be much bigger than this room. And it would be more like 50% or 40, 50, 60% even, because that was in the day and that stuff was really saleable. And it did sell. I mean, you know.
You knew there wasn't a huge risk then.
Yeah. Well, actually, you know, it's hard to say definitely that you knew that, because really you don't know.
It's
instinct, yeah. And it's taking a shot. But you know, like each time we do a catalog, you know, there's a couple of books in there and you think, man, they'll be breaking our fingers for this book, right? And then it's the one that doesn't sell. And then Liam will say, oh, we just sold that, and you'll say, geez, I just chucked that in there. That was the bone from the soup, you know. I threw it in. It filled up a space. No, he says, we had three orders for it. Jeez. Will I ever? So you just, you know, really, you don't know. But you're just trusting your instincts are really. Somebody said to me one time, you know, you learn just about everything from your customers. Somebody said to me in the store, geez, he says, your instincts are so good. Why wouldn't you trust them more? And I said, like, that was news to me. I had no sense of that. And I thought, geez, maybe he's right. Maybe I should just, you know, go with how you feel about it. Just let her go from there. I know my father certainly did that all his life.
He was in the bus business.
Yeah, he had no problem trusting his instincts. So, yeah, and then, you know, other collections like Bert Plymer spent 40 years, and then we did that catalog. It took me a year to produce that catalog. It grossed pretty close to $500,000, I think.
What was that collection on?
Franklin Search items. Okay. Probably the best Franklin Search collection. Like, he had onboard ship printing and stuff like that. You know, on the McClintock things, they had plays to keep the men happy, or try to keep them busy and onboard ship. And they printed, they had a press on board, and they right. printed playbills this size and posted them up around the ship, you know, like, so Bert had some of those things. And he really was kind of meticulous in terms. He went to England a lot. He was a journalist, TV journalist. And so he traveled a lot. You couldn't mention a place without Bert having a story that he could tell you because he'd been there at one time or another. We used to go to lunch once a week. Bert would be saying, did I ever tell you about the time we flew over Victoria Falls in the 1958? That sort of thing. He bought a lot of stuff in England. He was well known in the trade. And Bert would find a way. He would always find a way to digest the book. He would do a little trading if he had to.
Acquire the book?
To acquire a book. Like, if a book came up and it was a book he didn't have and it's a book he should have and he didn't have the money, Bert would find a way. He would get he'd get you to hold it. He was as good as gold if he said, it's going to take me 3 months, and he'd be right tickety-boo on the thing, you know. So people trusted him like that. And or he'd trade a duplicate, or he, you know, he always found a way to make it work. I know another collector who's like that, and he has unbelievable collections. He does sell on occasion, but only because he needs to buy something even better.
Right.
He's not focused on selling at all. He's focused on acquiring. So it takes real guts, I'm telling you. or an extremely patient partner.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, Jerry Sherlock, anything else on Jerry?
Well, I think if you talk to David Mason or Steve Temple or Hugh Hansen Cartwright, like, just about everybody had a very high opinion of Jerry Sherlock. He was good humored. He was very generous. They used to say, Jerry, I think, had 5 or 6 kids. Now I'm confused. And he used to say, if you ask him about Lyell's geological travels in Canada in 1848, Jerry could say, yeah, published in London by Cadell, 1838, 2 volumes, should have 6 plates. Sometimes it has 7. If you ask him how many kids he'd have, he'd sit there.
He had his priorities, eh?
He had his priorities. Oh, there was some great car. I remember Stanley Crowe, John Coles and I went in there one time in the 80s. And Stanley Crowe was up near the British Museum. And everybody in the world knew Stanley Crowe. They did catalogs. And so you went in this place and you went down those iron stairs that you see, the circular ones. And to me, there was dirt on the floor. I don't know. But there, and so there was this little wee thing, and there's Stanley Crowe right near the door. And he had one of those big blue serge coats on, you know, that were popular in the day. And yeah. It was worn at the collar. and worn here where it buttoned, and the edges were worn. You know the serial picture of the antiquarian bookseller, you know?
Yes.
What, little worn at the edges, which is a term you use. Well, Stanley Crow was a little worn. He was the nicest man in the whole world, honest to God. And for 20 minutes, he explained why he was too busy to let us look around. But the next time we came, just let him know beforehand we could even have lunch, you know. But he would not let us in. That was it, you know. And then, of course, there was all that problem of shipping books to America. And if you let us in, we'd probably buy a whole bunch of books. And he's too busy to ship. And as we left, John Cole said to me, yeah, you got to try. He says, that happens one out of two times. Other times he lets you in. I remember a guy in England, Marty Alvinus, used to talk about him. And if you went there late in the year, he'd have you sit on the bench if you were a bookseller, and he'd talk to you for an hour, but he wouldn't let you look at his books because he only sold a certain volume, and then he shut the door. He locked her up and he wouldn't let anybody in. Because he didn't want to pay any more. He hated government and he didn't want to pay any more taxes than he had to. A friend of mine got around that by persuading him to let him in and look at the books, but he could keep them till the new year. Yeah. So.
Okay, you've mentioned Bernard Amtmann a few times. Maybe you can give me some words on him.
Well, Bernard Amtmann, he founded Antiquarian Booksellers. He came to Canada after the war. He started in Ottawa. And he told me he went to Johnson's Furniture on Murray Street, you remember.
Yeah.
And he bought a sectional case. And he was asking the guy about the price. And the guy said to him, Mr. Johnson, no, he said, the case includes the books in it, and you have to take the books. So he bought the case, and he brought them home, all Canadiana, and he thought, gee, this looks too good to just, you know, there were Harriets and all those kind of things. So he did a list and sent it out to a couple of libraries, and the books were like $2 and $4 and $5. And he sold most of them. And he said to himself, gee, this is easy. I'm going to get into the book business. But his first smart move was he moved out of Ottawa to Montreal. He really was a kind of the dominant figure across the country. He didn't mind controversy, but he was really a dedicated bookseller. I mean, they used to say Bernard's idea of relaxing was to sit on the balcony on Sunday in the sun in his bathing suit and read TPL or something like that. Read a bibliography page.
Yes.
He was also, he was quite generous. He had a lot of, in the early days, he had a lot of stock. And I remember going there one time, he had pamphlets that, well, this would go on too long to explain all that, but he had a huge pamphlet collection.
He was before his time as far as being high on ephemera.
And he was really like Canadiana in the larger sense of the word, you know.
Yeah.
And then he started Montreal Book Auctions, and then he partnered with Christie's, which that didn't go very well. And then Craig Fraser, actually I was involved in that, bought it and moved it to Toronto and became Canada Book Auctions. Bernard lived into his 70s and then kind of just died very suddenly and quickly, actually. His brother was Willie Amtmann, who was at Ottawa U and wrote one of the first histories of music in Canada before the big one that was done by, what's his name? I forget now.
Right. Where do you think, just winding down here, where do you think the market right now for Canadian rare books and ephemera is? Is it, well, there, I'll leave that.
It's individuals entirely.
It's not institutions.
Boy, I could really get into a lot of trouble. Well, there certainly are still a few, you know, like TPL and Queens. A librarian has to be working for somebody who values what he or she's doing if they're acquiring for a collection. And that's kind of muddled at the moment, you know, like the National Library, I think, has spent more time on online books and that kind of thing. I offered a nice collection that I bought in the States to the National Library of Denmark. And the librarian actually was in Ottawa and he came to the store and I was kind of excited to go down. And he told me they didn't care. They didn't want them. They didn't want to have anything to do with it. And I said, well, what about your students? I mean, this is all stuff on the north, on Greenland. And, you know, it's right up. I've been selling them stuff for 40 years, you know. And he said, well, that's it. He said, the students don't care about this stuff. He said, if they want it, they look it up online. And so he said, right now, you know, we might buy the odd rare book here or there, but we're not buying general books, period. I don't know. So on the other hand, I know of a couple of institutions. One of them is very keen on any early Canadian law that they don't have, even in an ephemeral sense, but they have just about everything, really. It's hard to sell them a book these days, but they're still kind of keen on that. We had a Ralph Connor manuscript and a friendly colleague said, man, you'll never sell that. And I said, yes, I will. And I know who I'll sell it to. And I didn't quote it directly. I offered it and I made sure that the catalog went to that one person. And sure enough, you know, there was $5,000. So it wasn't insignificant. The other thing about some institutions is they never really have any money. You hear that all the time. We don't have money. We don't have money. When you have something they want, they have money. So it's
what do they want?
Well, that's the thing. I had a really nice thing. It was by Canadian Pacific, one of the first guides that they did. It's so rare, I didn't even know, you know, I had no sense. You're talking about bibliographies, neither did anybody else. It was like long before. And it showed the properties along the line. So almost unique, really. And man, you know, all kinds of people came alive. You know, the lights just gone like Christmas trees there.
So there is an interest then. It's just a question of what? Figuring out where it lies. Is that it?
Yeah, from my perspective, which probably be different, it's, you know, having done it for a long time. But, you know, actually, when you think about it, I'm 51 years. Liam is like, I don't know what he is, more than 25 years. He knows a hell of a lot more right now than I did at that point, my sense of it is. And then Clive has been working for us for, I don't know, 30 years. Even Jeremy, he works for us 2 days a week, Fridays and Saturdays, sometimes another day. But Jeremy's been in the book trade for a long time. So out of the four of us, we might have a chance of figuring it out once in a while. Nigel, I don't think you ever actually know. And maybe if you did, the whole thing wouldn't hold the intrigue that it does, you know.
Right. The mystery.
Yeah. And there's always, it's the variant. You get really keen on the variants. You know, you're talking about Canadian literature. And I found a book a couple of months ago, which it was kind of a standard book, but it was an American edition. The cover had an ad on for books that aren't included in the Canadian version of that book. I think it was about 1870. So, you know, anybody interested in the Canadian novel in the 19th century would find that really interesting. I mentioned a librarian, you know, who knew somebody right away who taught a course on the Canadian novel from that period. So that's the kind of stuff of life at the moment. That and maybe working too hard. I still like do 8-10 hours a day and I'm 75. And actually, you know, you talk about Antman and Sherlock and all. Like, I don't think that that would have ever occurred to Bernard Antman or Jerry Quack. That, you know, just like somebody talking about retirement, that would be completely a foreign concept. I feel like I've got too much time digging in this earth to just sort of walk away from it. I mean, what would be the point? Where would you go? What other fields would there be? I said to Marius when he was doing an interview, for as long as I've been in business, I keep doing this because I've never really hit on something else I'd rather be doing. Therefore, my conclusion is I must be doing what I want to do.
Yeah. Process of elimination.
It's not that it's euphoria or anything like that. It's just, for now, it's the best thing.
Well, it's keeping you alive.
It is, yeah. Yeah. Actually, I know I look 75, but I'm really only about 48, so.
Yeah. Anything else, anyone else that we've missed that you think should get some recognition?
Well, my wife, who's put up with this all these years, you know, actually my wife, she grew up in a family business, and so did I. So I think that's actually good, because there aren't that kind of, you know, false kind of ideas about what life and work is are about. And then I also, Liam, you know, when he started to work for me, his energy level, that's really allowed me to be in the business the way I want to be in the business. I frankly get to do the best of the best most of the time.
What is that?
Well, maybe this. Or if you look around it. I come in here every morning at like 7:30, quarter to 8, and I tell you, honestly, God, it's like I come here, my mind's already loaded for, you know, the shotgun is loaded. Like, I got things I want to do every day. I begin to wear down about midday now. Sometimes I might have to go and lie on the couch and read for a half an hour to get the batteries back up. But the functioning of the business, this business is precarious. You're always worried about money. It never goes away. And yet having somebody like Liam or somebody who's younger, who has that energy, you know, that's a big thing, really. I mean, that's added a lot of miles to my road, actually. So I'm fortunate in that way. I think most of my colleagues realize that too. David Mason loves to say to me, Liam will be a much better bookseller than you ever were.
That sounds like David.
Yeah, but it's not true, is it? No, it doesn't. You know what? It doesn't matter. It's not really about that. It's not really about who's best or whatever. You, Anson Cartwright, said to me one time, we must never forget, it's not about the personalities, it's about the books. And he was right in that. That's a good thought.
Well, Patrick, thank you for sharing your personality with me. It's been great to reconnect, and I really admire what you've done with your life.
Thank you very much. I'm quite happy to do this.
Well, best of luck for the next 50.
That's it. That's it. Okay, talk to you later.
You betcha.